may be boring, but his guests aren't. It's Al's Boring Podcast.
Oh, hi there. Al Dukes here. And my guest today on the podcast is Mark Mason. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Al.
Now, you are the VP of Digital Media for CBS New York.
Yes, sir.
I looked on your LinkedIn page. You spent some years at WFAN. You're credited with putting together Mike and Chris, Mike and the Mad Dog.
Credited is one way to put it.
I like that. You spent some time at ESPN.
I did.
Many years at 1010 Wins.
I did.
And now you're doing the digital thing here.
I am. And it's been quite a checkered career.
Now, you've worked in radio a long time. So I want to get to, you know, a lot of this, the FAN stuff, 1010 Wins, and that sort of thing. So when did you come to WFAN?
Well, I came to FAN. I was brought in by Jeff Smullyan and Rick Cummings after Emmis bought the NBC stations. So I'm trying to think back. I can't remember what I had for breakfast. But
now on your LinkedIn account, it said 1988.
Right. So I got there. We were still 1050, and all of the FCC stuff was going through for the purchase. And we flipped on October. It was a Mets-Dodgers playoff game. This is way before the wild cards. I think it was October 7th, 88. But I had gotten there a couple of months before.
And what brought you there? Like, how do you get to come work at WFAN? It was the first and only sports station. It was less than a year old.
Well,
right?
I had come from WABC, where I started on May 10th, 1982, the day the music died. Watching Dan Ingram and Ron Lundy crying in the studio at noon when the station signed off. That was a momentous day. Big, giant, agate headlines in the Post and the News the day the music died.
And why did it die? Why did they want to change it? Were people no longer going there for music? And why?
It died for, it was really the beginning of the end of music on AM. And WKTU came along as a disco station. Not long before 82, maybe it was 80, 81, and they went from nowhere to a 12 share. And WABC went from a 10 share to a 3 share.
So everyone went there, clearly.
Well, they did. And then the great legendary programmer, Rick Sklar, sort of was, I think, taken off track a little bit, or finally just decided in an act of desperation to start playing the music they were playing. And they played less of the stuff that they were known for. So they took the station off brand because it had lost so much traction. And that was the kind of kiss of death, coupled with the fact that the guy that was now running the ABC radio division, Ben Hoberman, had a very successful talk station in Los Angeles, KABC. And the model was then to take all of the AM, the ABC AM stations. We had, I think, 7 and 5 FM. That's all you could own at the time. And we all went talk at that point.
Now, what do they put on there? And where do they get these people?
Well, there was network programming that came out of L.A. and San Francisco, and it was hideous.
Yeah, that wouldn't work in New York, right?
It didn't work in New York, although we had to carry it in New York for a couple of years. And then Bob Grant, who I used to work with at WMCA, got fired again. I had brought Bob back from Philadelphia because he'd been fired from MCA for saying something icky, went down to Philly. I convinced the MCA ownership to bring him back. Then I went to WABC. He got fired at MCA, and we put Bob on. I was only allowed to put him on at night. They were too afraid to put him on when the sun was shining. So Bob went in there, I think, at 9 o'clock at night, following Art Russ Jr.'s Sports Talk, which we can talk about in a minute. That's how I got from ABC to FAN, really. And Bob took a. We had a Dr. Judy Kuriansky, who would, you know, was one of the many radio shrinks at the time. There were five radio shrinks on that those couple of years. There were five sports talk shows on at the same time that year. Anyway, Bob went to WABC and took us to something like a 15 chair. It was ridiculous. Ultimately, he got fired there. He went to OR. He got fired again. He's passed on a couple of years ago, but one of the great AM performers. But Art Russ Jr. was the nonpareil of sports talk guys. I mean, Mazur started it all. But Art was in that old school mold. And had his sayings, you know, the big bowl orchard in the South Bronx and a whole bunch of others. And he was loved and adored, and he was part of this talk lineup. He also came from WABC, where he did weeknights and John Sterling did weekend talk. Don't start me on that.
So before FAN existed, sports talk shows had existed for a while, but they would just be one show on a talk station that was filled with all types of different talk shows, and at night they would throw on a sports talk show.
Right. So you had Art Russ Jr. on ABC. You had Rick Cerrone, not the baseball player, on WOR maybe. I think Richard Neer was doing a show on NEW. They were literally, and Howie Rose was on 1050. Oh, and Dave Sims was on 66, and you know who his producer was, of course.
Who is that?
He's now doing a play-by-play all over the country.
Dave Sims' producer?
Yeah.
Who is that?
Come on.
I don't know. I don't have any idea.
Mike Breen.
Mike Breen.
Mike Breen. So Mike was Dave's producer at WNBC. And it's a small world, isn't it?
Yes.
Fabulous guy. And a mensch.
What is a mensch, by the way? I hear Eddie plays that all the time when we do the Adorama commercials.
It's funny. There's some words that translate from Yiddish to English and some that don't translate too well. But I think broadly speaking, he's just a good guy. Not a bad bone in his body.
Right.
Not a... you know, one of these backstabbing guys who climbs all over people to get where he wants to get.
So why was FAN looking for somebody to take over for this job that you got?
The station had kind of floundered for a year.
Did they think it wasn't a thing that could be, you know, a 24-hour sports talk station when it didn't really take off right away?
Well, the lore and the facts surrounding the birth of the station are interesting because Jeff Smullyan, who was Letterman's, I think, college classmate at Butler, maybe?
Ball State.
Yeah. Ball State. Was a huge sports fan, particularly college hoops, but he was a huge sports fan and wanted to do this all sports thing. So he ran this company called Emes Communications, and Emes, of course, is Yiddish for truth. So he was a truth teller, which seems oxymoronic in our business, but it was a different time. So he owned a research company called Emes Research that I had used at other broadcast places, and I thought they were terrific. So his board of directors told him he was crazy. Let's research this and ask people if they would listen to all sports radio. When you ask people, would you listen to something that you've never heard before and you have no idea what it means, and it sounds like an awful idea, surprisingly, the research came back and said, absolutely not.
Yeah, no one cares.
What a stupid idea. So the research was overwhelmingly against the idea. His board of directors was overwhelmingly against the idea. And he said, well, I'm going to do it. And he bought 1050 from, I guess it was owned by Storer or Doubleday. Doubleday Broadcasting. So we bought the team from the guy that owned the Mets, of course. But it was not a very good signal. And it started out with a lot of out-of-towners. It started out kind of off track. They spent money that was astronomically stupid. They would fly in, I won't mention names, well, they would fly in Lou Botta, I think from Florida, and put him up in the, you know, like the Ritz or something, just to do sportscasts. And they spent, we lost, I think, $4 million in the first year. So this is 1987. I don't know what that's equivalent today, probably $10 million. Can you imagine any operation losing $10 million on a radio station? And the second year it lost $2 million on 66. But Art Russ Jr. was number one. He was on from 6 to 8, up against four other shows. And he was number one in every male demographic. He was the youngest skewing show on the radio station. He was number one men 18 to 34 on an AM radio station. So I knew that in this town, I certainly believed in it. I bought the idea. The programming needed a lot of work. The production values needed a lot of work. But it had a great production staff. They had some fabulous people. When I got there, Eric Spitz was already there. I think he was might have been born under the console, or they found him in a manger.
I think he could have been Baba Booey. He was like
he could have been.
He was like he worked there with Boy Lee, who
right.
who then
there. Yeah. So, but I was convinced, Al, that the format, if we could get it right, would work. I would tell you that. So anyway, I think what Smullyan and Cummings saw in me as I had programmed WABC, we made a pretty good go of it. We did very well on the sports side. I had the Yankees, which I produced. I had the Jets, which sounded pretty good. Charlie Steiner was a play-by-play guy at one point, and Steve Albert on another point, and the Yankees broadcast I thought sounded fabulous. But I knew that that's what they wanted. That's what they saw in me, and that's what they wanted me to, you know, to bring to the table. But I would tell you, were the station still on 1050, and had we not moved to Imus's house, it probably would have been out of business.
So a lot of the credit you would put to not only moving the signal to 660, but the fact that Imus was the morning man.
Absolutely.
Because he gave it legitimacy?
Well, the funny thing is, he didn't come to our house. We went to his house. And this was after Don was down and out. I mean, you've heard it all. You've read it all. It was worse than that. And his life was a mess. He turned it around and I think was reinvigorated by this thing that was wrapped around him. Because NBC, you know, once Stern left, kind of became an afterthought. And they were still playing music when nobody was listening to music anymore on AM. So when the station flipped on that... I'm trying to think what time it was, maybe 6 o'clock on October 7th. Al Roker was out at Shea. That's funny. He was out at Shea. We had this giant switch he flipped. I think it was the most complicated flip of stations in the history of New York. There were seven stations that had to move frequencies because of ownership limitations at the time. And... Alan Combs did the last show on WNBC. I can't remember the last song he played, but it ended at 6 o'clock, and he did the station ID. There was 10 seconds of dead air. Chief engineers all over town were throwing patch cords and doing all kinds of things. And then WFAN signed on with its first jingle, and Susan Waldman doing the first sportscast.
If you're a small business owner, you can do 1,000 things to find a great new hire. Or you can do one. Post with ProJob Network. Just one click, post your ad to over 40 different job sites. It would probably take you forever to do that. And even then, you wouldn't get the preferred placement that you'll get from ProJob Network. In about a day, you'll have a list of qualified local candidates to choose from. That's because ProJob Network will place your job in front of qualified candidates who've asked to hear about specific opportunities like yours. How great is that? You'll save time, you'll save money, and you'll find good people. Go ahead, try ProJob Network free for 1 week by visiting tryprojob.com/Al. That's tryprojob.com/Al. Post it, hire, genius. Try it free at tryprojob.com/Al.
It's Al's Boring Podcast with Al Dukes.
And when you got there, what were the big gaping holes that you thought you had to fix right away?
Well, the interesting thing is that most of the people in Indianapolis, where Imus is headquartered, didn't want to bring Imus to the radio station for two reasons. One, he wasn't a sports guy, and two, he was washed up. He still had some fairly loyal clients, although he had alienated some of them. One of the biggest clients on the station was Aer Lingus, and he tagged one spot with Protestants Fly Coach, and that was, I don't know, it was like a ridiculous, like a $500,000 contract. So in one phrase, you know, he had a tendency to throw that turd in the punch bowl every once in a while. But I knew we needed, I believed in him, and I believed we needed the tentpole. And had it not been for Don, who was the greatest marketing machine this station has ever had, a lot of people who are on the air today wouldn't be who they are. You know, it's hard to look back that far and say, well, is Mike where he is today? Is Mad Dog where he is today? Is Mike Breen where he is today because of Don? In part, sure. Because, you know, Russo, who I hired from WMCA, they had gone from talk to a religious format, so he was kind of out. Mike was at the station when I got there. He was working with Eddie Coleman in middays. It was a fairly unlistenable show. And I love, you know.
And Coleman was the lead on that show?
Coleman was the lead, yeah. And so the station was, so Gumbel, I'm trying to think of what was going on. Was it
Greg
Lampley?
Gumbel?
Yeah, Greg Gumbel. It was a whole mess because there was a period of time between the Imus buying the station and the deal actually closing and the FCC approving it. I think at one point, for a couple of weeks, Minko was our morning guy. And I don't know. You ever hear the David Lee Roth show?
I produced that show.
You did.
Yeah,
you did. Yes. What was I thinking?
Yeah, that was terrific.
It was a great show.
Yes.
Minko was in that
similar
vein.
Similar dynamic.
And he stepped up to the plate. It was, you know, John, we'd like you to do morning drive for the next month. He goes, okay. And it was, we had Lampley and Gumbel. I think Greg Gumbel's contract was up, and he wasn't going to stick around. So before we picked up Imus, we had Minko in there. But it was, so we started with Don, and then we had Eddie and Mike. And then there was the Pete Franklin disaster. Pete, who was a star in Cleveland, came to New York and basically imploded. Talented guy, old school, loved opening his show with this Nelson Riddle tune that I had a hard time getting him to stop playing. But he was the antithesis of what I wanted the station to be.
What did you want and what was he?
I wanted the station to be of the fans. I wanted the station to be friendly and welcoming.
And Pete Franklin was an angry guy.
Pete Franklin was an angry, hateful
guy. Wasn't Imus an angry guy?
Imus was and I've worked with a lot of talent, but probably the most talented guy I've ever worked with. So he was, you know, he had streaks of anger, but he would, the mic would go off and he would break out laughing. He was very self-deprecating. It was one of the great things about him. You know, he would start ragging on Lou or Chuck or anybody within eyesight or me. And then he would just turn it around on himself and, you know, say, what a jerk am I for, you know. But he was the single greatest driver of putting Fan on the map. He saw talent. He knew talent. He was playing, I think, 6 songs an hour, maybe 8 songs an hour. Loved Motown music. And I love Motown music, but I didn't think the station ought to be playing any music. And he had a great surrounding cast, supporting cast, I should say. And we weaned him off the music after probably took us 4 to 6 months to wean him off the music. We went from 8 to 6 to 4 to 2 to none because he couldn't imagine how he was going to fill the time. And fabulous interviewer. Chuck wrote wonderful material for Larry and Rob. It was a real show. You guys in the morning have a real show. It's the first time New York has had a show like this in a long time. And that's what Don was. It was a real show. It wasn't a talk, you know. So a couple of guys just talking. It was highly, highly produced, and it was entertaining. And Don was very, very smart, used sports as a springboard for most of the things he did. It didn't play so well sometimes with our broadcast teams, like the Mets, because what did he call Frank Cashin? Oh, yeah, that bridge troll, Frank Cashin. He did look a little like a bridge troll, but he said what was on his mind. So Pete, and then we had the great Howie Rose and Steve Summers doing his thing. Imus would come in the morning, and of course the studio was a disaster. And Smokey and Imus talked about the mushrooms that were growing under Summer's armpits, and it was a station that once we made the decision to take Pete off the air, which was a difficult sell to the guys in Indianapolis. I was out there with the then general manager Scott Meyer at a company meeting. We were sitting around a pool with Smullyan and Rick Cummings, the head of programming. And I said, Pete Franklin has to go. And that just like everybody's looking at me like I have 5 heads. What are you talking about? We paid him $200,000 the first year, $300,000 the second year. It's a guaranteed contract. He's all over our TV advertising and billboards all over town. I said, yeah, but he's killing the radio station. It's this toxic, negative approach. And Pete was legitimately angry. He was just an angry guy. And I guess that worked in Cleveland, where he had been for years. He came into New York trying to sound like Bob Grant. Well, Bob got away with it because he didn't start out quite like that. When Bob came from L.A., he ramped it up. Pete started at 100 miles an hour, trying to be Bob Grant, but didn't have any of the credibility. So Smullyan said, "Well, who are you going to replace Pete with? We don't have anybody who can pull that weight." I said, "Well, we're going to put Francesa and Russo in there." Now this is after Don had done a fabulous job promoting both Mike and Chris. Chris did his sports cast for a while. I think we started with the great Don Crickey and ultimately wound up with a variety of people, including including Mike Breen and Russo. And
so Russo was doing sports updates during the Imus show.
It was hilarious.
And Mike was on the show following Imus.
Right.
What made you think they would go together and do a show?
I was bored by, with the exception of Howie and Steve, I was bored with one guy behind a microphone just taking calls. I was bored with that at WABC, with the exception of Bob Grant, who was one of the great entertainers and also didn't take himself so seriously.
You wanted a team back there.
I wanted a team. I wanted guys who could, particularly on slow days, stir it up. And I thought the right pairing would be sort of 1 + 1 = 3 or 4. I didn't want 1 + 1 = 2. I didn't want guys who were just talking sports. I wanted a couple of very different guys. So we sat around this pool, and they knew about Mike. They really hadn't ever heard Chris. And so I said, I'm going to pair this, the heavy Italian guy from Long Island with the skinny Long Island guy from Long Island. And they're local, and they're passionate, and I thought they would be a great team. So they reluctantly bought into it. And they said, all right, young man, you can have your way, but if this doesn't work out, you know, it's not going to be so. But anyway, we went ahead with this, and again, Imus was the greatest driver because he was just a fabulous supporter of the show. The whole Francesa thing with St. John's winning the NCAA, I'll give you a Porsche. I still have that little radio-controlled Porsche that he gave him. I think I have that at home. But it was a unmitigated disaster in the beginning. I remember driving home the first day, across the Whitestone Bridge, and thinking, these barriers are not really that high along the side of the road.
He could just drive right
off.
What
would happen? Because I thought I'd wrecked the radio station. I'd ruined my already checkered career. And I couldn't understand a thing Chris was saying because he was so hyped up. And then I start getting, come in the next day, and the sales department, of course, Gelb was the producer. Sales department is all over me that advertisers want to cancel because Chris can't read a commercial. Mike doesn't want to read the commercials. Chris, you can't understand a thing he's saying. And it took a long time for them to find their groove. But once they found it, it was really, really magical and kind of set this template for what sports radio became in a lot of places. Boomer and Carton, you know, I wouldn't say they're in the mold of Mike and the Mad Dog, but because it's more of a, it's a bigger show, it's much more highly produced. But the idea of a couple of very different guys mixing it up is kind of in keeping with that. And they had a great 19-year run. Boy, there were bumps in the road. A lot of bumps in the road.
Yeah.
But they were a gas to work with.
And do you think, in thinking that, like I always would think that there's only so many hardcore sports fans. So you need, your shows kind of need to reach people that are even casual sports fans. And a show like Mike and Chris, Boomer and Craig, they people will listen to that who don't necessarily watch every Knick game or every Ranger game. They're entertaining shows.
Right. I believed that when guys got out of work, and again, with the reach of a signal like 66, you got a lot of guys in their cars coming home from work, a lot of commuters, that there was a lot of interest in sports, but that would get us so far that if it was just hardcore sports, we weren't going to get to the promised land. And that's the equation that Chris filled out because he was just nuts. in a great way. You know, kind of a, I don't know, Daffy Duck, or he's been described as a lot of different things. And it's funny, he's got to be 50 what now? 50, mid-50s?
Yes.
And I said to him one day, are you going to be Mad Dog when you're like 55?
Right.
I don't know, Mark. Maybe. And, you know, he had his Saturday show by himself. Mike had his Sunday show by himself.
Yeah, I always wondered, why? 5 days is not enough to, don't you want the weekend to relax? Like, I don't understand why those guys, and Mike still does a Sunday show. Why?
Well, there were a bunch of reasons. I had trouble finding good talent for the radio station. Number two, when we started the process, they were both doing weekend shows that I didn't want them to give up. Number three, they clearly enjoyed working alone. And it gave them that outlet,
right?
For Mike to do his, you know, his football show on Sundays, and we had, you know, with Spitzy and a lot of other terrific producers, we did fabulous work with stringers all over the country on those football shows, which we later expanded into a college football show. Steve Levy, before he went to ESPN, Ian Eagle was doing some great stuff. Eddie Coleman was doing a couple of those shows. So I wanted the weekend to carry through from the weekdays, so it wasn't a totally different station. I know it's like nuts to think about doing that today. And they were not on for 5.5 hours. It was a 4-hour show. So when you think about Mike now, I have no idea how he does that.
I don't either.
It's to think about talking that long, let alone staying focused and engaged, it's really. I tell him that when I see him in the hall. I said, I still don't know how you do this.
Are both of those guys still friendly with you?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Do you feel like they appreciate that you put them together and did that stuff, or is it so long ago? It's taken for granted.
They've always been very. Grateful maybe is not the word, but they've always acknowledged it. They still talk about it when we did the anniversary show and I came on and talked to Mike. It was fun. It was the Wild West. When we look at what this station is today and you look at the facilities, I mean, this is pretty fabulous.
Yeah, nice.
We were in a crap hole. It was a hell hole. And we loved it, but we were probably all getting some sort of disease. The bathroom, we were in the basement in Astoria. Everybody's heard this story a million times, but the bathroom, they used to have to pump the effluents from the toilet upstairs and out of the building because we were down 20 feet below. We were in what was Esther Williams' swimming pool when they shot the silent movies. And then it was like a bomb shelter for the neighborhood, but it was underground and flooded and horrible. The bathroom was right across from Pete's office and would overflow all the time. And my office was right around the corner, and it was just the most disgusting thing you could imagine, and it happened all the time. And the stuff would creep out across the carpet into Pete's office. It would leach like a toxic dump. And he got on the air one day, and you know, his theme would roll, and he would start his show. And then he spent probably 5 minutes in this froggy voice describing the toilet. And then he must have said, "Fix the crapper, fix the crapper," 200 to 300 times. I'm sitting in my office laughing. I just couldn't, you know, I wanted to go in there and say, just do your show, but it was sort of quintessential Pete, and I was hoping that they would actually fix the crapper.
Right. Yeah, maybe if he keeps yelling.
It was disgusting. But physically a horrible facility, but it was a great. It was a team that was put together all at the same time. Everybody was rooting for each other. Most stations today, there are the talent can be kind of fractious, and I've worked with other stations too, and it just, you know, there's pecking orders and all kinds of egos involved. But the fact that Don was the cheerleader and everybody was on board and everybody was part of it, and Steve Summers sitting there in the middle of the night, invisible, except for Imus, who took the Summers cult following and helped build that awareness. And what Don did for Chris and Mike and everybody else, Breen was one of the greatest sportscasters ever because he fit into that Imus show and wrote material. I think Jerry's a little bit of a chip off that block, but Breen took dry scores and just made funny stories. And you still sort of got a sense for what was going on, you know. Not that anybody cared about the Dodgers so much till they got to New York, but it was hilarious. And everybody was talking about everybody else.
Is it surprising to you, looking that it's 2015, that Imus is still on the air, that Mike is still on the air, that Steve Summers is still on the air? Like, all those guys from all those years ago are still doing their radio thing.
Look, guys like Don or Scott Shannon don't have to be working. But they love it. It's what they do. It's who they are. It's their identity, you know. And Mike has a wonderful family and lots of stuff and lots of love and all that. But I'm thinking Mike's going to be on the air for a long time.
Yeah.
All kinds of discussion about who, what, when, where. It's what Mike does. And it's what people... He's such a part of the fabric of this city. Very different show from Mike and the Mad Dog. And when I think about that having been a 19-year run, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, pretty good.
About Boomer Kartner on for how long now?
We've done eight years.
Eight. So that was double that, right? And this
eight years,
it's been a great 8 years, but it's 8 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
And to keep a team together for that long... I was sad that they broke up. I thought, you know, towards the end, I thought it was kind of inevitable, but, they were so special together. However, it was like a marriage, and they spent more time together than they did with anybody outside their lives, more waking hours.
Right.
And, that creative friction after a while and the maturation process, I guess, is what sort of eventually drove a wedge. I still think they probably are, I don't know, but I think they're probably still friendly.
Seems like it now.
It does. I can tell you that with my own eyes and ears for, you know, a long time, they were as close as anybody, any broadcast people I've ever seen. They had a lot of arguments off the air and on the air. They were difficult to manage, but very high performing. So when you have high performing broadcasters who are difficult to manage, that's what I'm paid to do.
Right.
You have difficult people who are not performing and not popular and not successful, they generally don't last too long in this business. So those guys were as entertaining off the air and as challenging off the air as they were great on the air together.
Right. Was there a guy ever in your FAN career or at ESPN where you thought this guy's going to be a big star and for some reason or another it didn't pan out?
I can probably think of more examples of guys who, when I first met them, knew they would be stars. I tried not to associate myself with people that I thought would fail.
Right. You know, let me hitch my wagon to this guy.
Yeah.
So who are some guys, like, when you first saw them, you thought, big things, and then big things happened?
Breen, Steve Levy, and Ian Eagle. And it was, and of course, Ian and Steve came out of Syracuse, which was the, you know, sort of grooming grounds for a lot of guys that wound up at ESPN. Big yes. Syracuse, you know. So I forget which, was it, might have been Ian. I said, so what do you want to do when you grow up?
And, he said, was he doing, board hopping at this point? He was a board op for Mike and the Mad Dog.
Yep. I said, so what do you, I said, I'm going to be Bob, the next Bob Costas. And I thought, well, either this guy is, you know, arrogant beyond belief, or he's going to be the next Bob Costas, or some, you know, something in between. But I thought it was sort of a ballsy thing to say, you know, he's 21. And I said, well, you know, Costas didn't just, it's not just Costas. No, I know. I'm willing to work that hard. And then as I sit there on a Sunday afternoon watching an NFL football game, a network television broadcast, and I hear Ian, or likewise for Breen doing a whole variety of sports, and his basketball stuff is just is superb. The ability for somebody to, at the tender age of 21, think they can be Costas or think they can be whoever. And I watched, you know, and I watched Charlie Steiner blossom. I had the privilege of working with Mike Tirico, who was a, you know, becoming a star at ESPN, but you could see that ability and the naturalness to it. And then working with Olbermann and Dan Patrick, who also did the ESPN radio network because I spent 3 years there. Probably that's why I say I wouldn't trade a minute of this, of any day, of any year, or of any place.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It's Al's Boring Podcast.
So if you were at FAN for a little over 5 years, mm-hmm. it seems like. That, why would you leave that, or did someone tell you to leave?
Somebody told me to leave. Mr. Hollander invited me out the door.
Why?
I can't really answer that question.
You're not sure?
No, I'm not sure.
So everything was going smoothly, you thought?
I thought so.
And he said...
he said, you know, we got this guy... actually, one day he said to me... You know this guy, Mark Chernoff?
Who was a rock guy.
Yeah, he was a K-Rock guy.
K-Rock, N-E-W.
Yeah, I've known him for a long time. What do you think of him? He said, great guy. Little did I know. So anyway, and I love, you know, to this day, Cherny and I get along very, very well.
Well, I had Mark in here a couple of weeks ago, and the way he tells the story is that they had asked him to come work at FAN, and he said, no, and I like this rock thing. They're like, no. They're essentially saying, you're going to work there or you don't have this job.
Yeah. So listen, it's that kind of business.
But you would think when it's going smoothly and things are going well, the radio station wasn't taking a dive, you know.
You would think that,
you
yes.
were work. You had a good relationship with the afternoon fellas, which, and Imus probably, right?
Yeah,
you didn't have any run-ins with those guys.
Yeah.
I would think smooth sailing.
You would.
I would be like, so you were shocked when that happened.
I was shocked. And then I had the opportunity to either go to ESPN.
Radio or television?
It was general manager of the radio network.
Which was what at that point?
It wasn't what it is today.
Right. It wasn't a 24/7 operation.
No, it was, we programmed 7 hours on Saturday night and 7 hours on Sunday night. And
because the sports stations around the country would do their own local thing during the week. They didn't want to pay weekend people.
Well, FAN took it as well. We had Keith Olbermann, Dan Patrick, who were platooning. They did this before their sports center. Mike Tirico, Tony Bruno, one of the funniest guys you'll ever meet. Chuck Wilson, who had come up from Providence, and it was this seven-hour radio program that we started. I worked for John Walsh, who is maybe the smartest intellect I've ever worked for. wouldn't have known a radio from a washing machine, but he was a brilliant, brilliant guy, a brilliant journalist, and brought me in because I was the, you know, the fan guy, the radio guy, and we expanded the network. We picked up NBA rights. We ultimately added the fabulous Sports Babe during the week.
Yes.
That was a roller coaster. How's that for it?
I worked with the Babe for in her last job before she went away for a while when she was at Sports Fan.
Yes.
I worked with her there, and she always had nice things to say about you. I had her on this podcast a couple weeks ago, and your name always popped up. But she would tell me that she was very difficult to work with.
Probably the most difficult talent. I've worked with difficult talent.
Yeah.
And I thought Nancy was immensely talented.
See, that was the first Monday through Friday ESPN radio show,
yes.
Right? Now,
yep.
Now, what? That was kind of back then to put a woman on in that slot.
Yeah.
For the first show.
Yep.
For the first show to pitch out there.
Yep.
How was that decision made?
Just because it was the way ESPN thinks. Let's do something different. She was in Seattle on KJR. I loved her sound. I loved the approach. We could have hired, I can't say we could have hired anybody we wanted, but it was.
Who else was in the running for that job?
I don't even remember. It was so many years ago.
Yeah.
There were probably a number of people from this radio station for it.
By then, the sports stations started popping up in larger cities.
Yeah, there weren't a ton of them. But they did start popping up, so the talent pool was not nearly as deep as it is today. But typically ESPN would have used one of its own homegrown people,
yeah.
Would have used a TV personality. There was discussion about moving Olbermann off of SportsCenter, moving Dan Patrick off of SportsCenter, conversation about Mike Tirico, Bob Lee. Charlie Steiner had just started when what we called The Deuce was launching, ESPN2, which was a hideous product at first. Because ESPN was like that. It got ahead of its own feet and was growing so fast beyond its capability because that was the culture there. You just, the expectation was excellence. So if you were pretty good, you had a pretty good show, you sucked. If you missed a fact or you missed a score, you didn't do some car race in some glen somewhere, you left out the car racing. Yeah, but the clock ran out. Well, you got to get that in. And you can't just do scores of games. You've got to give a fact for every game. This was the mantra. So you couldn't just say, you know, Dodgers 5, Reds 3. You had to say on a three-hitter by so-and-so in there. It was a very, a little bit of a Jonestown kind of culture up there in Hooterville, as the Babe called it. But these were very, very dedicated, driven people, and there was this thing, drive towards perfection. The Babe was totally not of that mold. She was probably the least disciplined, but one of the best performers I've ever worked with. And, you know, in this business, whether it's sports or news, you don't come in a half hour before a show and prepare, right? Because you're watching, you're reading, you're on your, back then before there was, barely before the internet. But she didn't come in and just prepare for the show. She knew what she hit the ground running, and she knew what she'd watched most of the games, and she had this dish and that dish at her house and everything. But she was in that entertainment mold. She knew her stuff, but didn't take herself too seriously. We had a lot of sound effects. I went to Chicago. And
she said you came up with hoo-wah.
Yeah, hoo-wah.
How did that happen? Like, she would take first-time caller. And you'd play the Al Pacino saying "Hoo-ah" from
Scent
of a Woman.
I remember bringing that. I had it on a not a DVR, not a DVD,
VHS,
a VHS tape. I had to bring in my 40-pound VHS player. We plugged it in. We had all kinds of hum, and I can't tell you what made me do that, except I was sitting at home one rainy weekend with my wife, and he did that hoo-ah, and I thought, that's got to be a thing. That's before I knew what a meme was, but
right.
We're going to make a thing out of that. And then we came up with the, after Nancy Kerrigan was hit in the knee with a pipe.
Yes.
By Tanya Harding's hooligans. We came up with the Galooly because Jeff Galooly, as I recall. Now, there's a name.
Yeah, Jeff Galooly.
Why do we remember the name of Jeff Galooly?
Great name. Great last name.
And so she would take out a caller who was boring her with the Galooly, which was a sound effect of a pipe hitting another pipe. And it was, you know, give him the Galooly, boys. But she was, I'm sorry she's not on the air today. We considered her actually in Pittsburgh when we were putting KDKA FM on the air. I still talk to her to this day. We email, we keep in touch. We had a tumultuous relationship. Oh God, if the walls could talk. There was one day we were out, because we used to travel everywhere. We went to every championship game. We went to the World Series, went to the Super Bowl, went to the Final Four. And I wanted my guys to work all the time. I wanted them to do she had to do a lot of affiliate work. So all the affiliates wanted to talk to, well, let's get the babe on the phone for our show. And Len Weiner was her producer. And I remember walking down the hallway media hotel, and I hear the unmistakable voice of the babe. Tell Mason to go F himself if he thinks, now you're walking by. Do you stop at that doorway?
No, you keep going.
Well, I stopped. I didn't have my ear to the door, but she was screaming so loud that I sort of slowed down a little bit. And you would think that would sort of wreck a relationship. But it didn't. It's what people do. Because in our business, if you are not passionate and not a little bit partly nuts, you're not interesting, you're not entertaining. You're like a guy like me. You're off the air. You're trying to manage people with giant egos, giant outsized personalities, and tremendous knowledge. I don't know how any of these guys do what they do. I never understood that because I was never able to do it myself.
Right.
I was never able to be that informed, that smart, that opinionated about any sport, about any player. I didn't have the encyclopedic knowledge that, you know, you think about what Mike brought to the table, to this radio station. We had Art Rust on for a little bit. Mazur did a midday show. The history of the station is really remarkable. And it's in a great facility. It was fabulous when it was in a shithole. Can I say that?
Sure.
On a podcast?
Yeah, definitely.
It was fabulous when it was the Wild West. We made more mistakes in the first couple of years. Because we were not, it was a different time in radio. You could make mistakes. In fact, you were encouraged to make mistakes. You were encouraged to try stuff. When you look at an industry like Broadway and you think about how many shows fail or how many restaurants open and close within 6 months, but the great ones that are still on Broadway or restaurants that are still hugely successful, they have something that's very, very unique, which the station has, which these guys, all of the people here have. I can't walk in or out of the building and run into Steve without a hug. That's been a long time since I've worked with him directly. We went through a lot together. We were grateful to each other because I thought, you talk about a mensch. Talk about a guy without a bad bone in his body. You talk about a guy that is quintessential FAN and quintessential New York. It's all I listen to going home. In fact, I get a little aggravated when there's a game on and he does
right,
a 10-minute
show. Talk shows.
It's and Howie Rose. I remember being called into Mel Karmazin's office with Joel Hollander because we had not the greatest ratings that period when the Mets just sucked. And I was called into Mel's office and taken to task for allowing all of the talent to speak what was on their mind. Howie, who was Mr. Met, would say all the time, "I have a free pass to go to. I have a free pass. I can go anywhere I want at Shea Stadium. I won't go to the games. They're that bad. The management is horrible. The players are horrible. They've all given up. I'm not going to the game. You shouldn't go to the game." And Mel said, "How do you as a manager allow your talent to say that?" I was a little bit taken aback. And Joel is looking at me like, "Don't screw this one up, buddy. Take us both down." I said, "I would never tell him anything other than attaboy." Mel looks at Joel. Joel looks at me. "Is this guy nuts?" He said, "Well, how do you expect that to help your ratings?" I said, I don't think about ratings that way. I think about putting content on the air that's honest and then that resonates with the fans. If you want somebody to go in there and tell our guys, and it certainly wasn't just Howie, Mike and Chris, everybody was hammering the Mets. It was a horrible year. I'm not going to do that. And you shouldn't do that either. Nobody should do that. Well, you've got to tone them down. I said, there's no such thing as a little cold water. And I'm not interested in even a little spritz. A little fine mist of cold water is not for me either. Because you can't do that. Because guys here, they don't see a mist. They see a fire hose of they're trying to shut me up. And I said, I won't do that. I won't do it here any more than I did it at ABC when the mayor used to get aggravated or clients got aggravated. And I said, I can't have an honest relationship with my staff if they don't have my support. And I was fairly sure I was going to get fired. I didn't get fired then, but that came a couple of years later. But it's the honesty, it's the relationship that this radio station and its personalities have with the fans of this town. It's now on its second generation. I mean, that's an amazing thing. When I think about how it was just nothing, nobody had heard of us, and then the buzz started, and I will say the station advertised. We spent a fair amount of money on TV and outdoor advertising. There were these billboards, you're too young to remember them. Giant one on the Bruckner as you were driving into the city.
Is that the one in Spitz's office? He's got on the wall.
Yep. Imus, Mike and Chris, and, you know, we've got New York sports by the dot, 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 and they're holding balls in their hands. And it was Wyden and Kennedy was the ad agency out of Seattle, the Nike agency. So the company spent money to put the station on the map. But the move to 66, the Imus support, the fact that Mike and Chris took off like a rocket, it's almost like the rest is history. And there's been a lot of competition, you know, and big name competition. But this station's the goods. It's just, it's the good goods.
And what's the thing now, you know, CBS bought an FM signal for WFAN 101.9, thinking that what, the young people don't go to the AM dial anymore, right? They don't even, wouldn't stumble upon you.
Statistically, it's probably in the neighborhood of, and it probably varies from month to month, 75 to 80% of adults 25-54 don't listen to AM.
Wow.
But the 20% who do are here.
Yeah.
To an extent, also 10-10 wins. But part of the problem is that AM radio has kind of self-destructed. Used to be a very vibrant dial. You know, if you were on AM, you had a signal like WABC or even an OR or an NEW. There was just better programming on AM. There was younger skewing programming on AM. And back in the day when you would dial a radio or you had five buttons on the dashboard of the Chevy, what did I had? I had a Ford. I paid $300 in high school.
Those were the
five buttons on.
Those were the presets back then.
Yeah.
Where you would hit it, it would actually jerk over to the side of the dial where it was supposed to be.
And I still have a scar on the back of my hand for when I was putting one of those FM adapters up under the dashboard back in the day. But flash forward to now, and there's just not enough other content on AM radio that's appealing to a younger audience. So the premise is you pick up that FM frequency, it gives you inherently a younger audience. It's certainly not for the reach, because this is one of the best signals, AM signals in the country.
Right.
But the theory is let's put the content where the ears are. And I don't, you know, Mark studies those numbers, I'm sure, day and night. But it's all about distribution, right? CBS wants to be on Channel 2. They want to be on Hulu. They want to be on All Access. They want to be on your phone, on your tablet.
And that's where we are now and what you do now in the digital side of things. So now FAN, we want to be on your phone. We're on the internet. We are podcasting different segments of shows. Let me ask you a few digital questions for you. These are questions I get all the time on Twitter and that sort of thing. One, why don't we podcast the entire Boomer and Carton show and the entire Mike Francesa show? Why pick segments versus podcasting the whole program?
Good question. I don't have an answer for that.
I have a theory.
Yes.
My theory is if it's all there, then what brings you to the radio station? And we still survive by ratings of people listening live on the radio. Perhaps.
Well, there are people who listen to other shows in the morning or the afternoon. There are people who are on vacation. There are people who are doing other things. It's an interesting question. And, of course, Boomer and Carton are on television, so there's that.
Yeah,
we're
all over
the
place.
Yeah. Certainly, we stream 24/7, but...
And we're the most streamed station in the country, is that right?
Yes, sir. Yep. And there are lots of people who, over the last 25 years, have left Dodge for parts elsewhere. Certainly, people who were moved to other cities or retired or what have you, and are still consuming the station in massive quantities. Sitting there, in West Palm with the iPad and a pina colada by the pool, listening to the station as though they were still in New York.
And they say that gives them a sense of home, right?
It does. It gives them that connection forever. And there's kind of a nostalgia thing about this station. Now,
yeah.
Back in the, when we were sort of backseat boys and girls growing up, when I was listening to WABC and Dan Ingram and all of those guys, and I hear that song today, let's say, when Scott Shamm driving in, and I might leave Boomer and Carton for a minute, see what Shannon's up to, and I hear that song. I flash back to, that song was on the radio when I got my learner's permit.
Right.
Or that song, it's like, remember the song, remember the car, remember the girl, remember the movies, remember all of that. Sort of now, today, because this place has been around a long time. Going to be 30 years old when? 2017?
Yes.
Amazing. It's a little more than half my life.
Yeah.
But there's kids who grew up backseat, boys and girls, as their fathers were listening to Mike and the Mad Dog, and now they have their own kids in the backseat. So
right.
there's that legacy feel to it, which gives these stations whole different dimensions. On the digital side, the question is that how do we distribute the content? in ways that are easily consumable. You know, we've heard for years that content is king, choice and control. I can't tell you that I've ever had a discussion with anybody about podcasting the entire show. The idea of giving it to people in consumable bites, you know, whether it's bits or interviews. And every morning, as you know, we're cutting lots of stuff from this show. We're posting some of the video from the sports network. You know, would people listen to an entire 4-hour, or in the case of Mike, a 5.5-hour show as right. a podcast?
Yeah, I mean, these shows are also made, you know, the old 10-10 wins motto, you give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world. People consume these radio shows in 20-minute chunks, so maybe if the entire 4-hour or 5.5-hour of Mike's show was podcast, it's a lot of repeating similar themes because people consume radio coming in and out. You get in the car, you get out of the car. So, yeah, do you listen to a 5-hour podcast? All about the, you know, what the Mets should have done on the ninth inning.
Right.
You know,
that's like imagining that you're gonna get to work at 8:30 and not turn the radio off because
right.
you want to hear the rest of the show. People don't behave like that. We are so totally used to time shifting everything in our lives. And I don't watch a ton of TV. But the series that I watch, you know, whether it's The Affair on Showtime or Homeland on Showtime.
That's nice. The company, those are company products.
You know, or loved watching House of Cards on Netflix.
Yeah.
Whatever. I don't, well, Netflix is, you know, they release the whole series at a time. Boardwalk Empire was great. I don't know when those shows are on anymore.
Right.
I don't know what channel they're on.
Right.
I don't know whether they're on my DVR, so I've got that remote. I don't know if they're on my Roku powering the Netflix and the Amazon Prime and the Hulu and everything else. So I got that remote out. And then I'm sitting there, you know, on the couch at night and my wife Peggy says, well, put the Affair on. And I go, what clicker is that?
Yeah,
and what,
which
right?
remote?
You know, so we're all about that now. And that's the beauty of live radio. People are consuming it live. And the stuff we're putting online does pretty well. The Boomer and Carton stuff does extremely well for us. We're very happy to have that content and feel very privileged to have it. But there's a lot of people consuming, essentially time shifting the best of Boomer and Carton. And whether it's Moment of the Day or the, you know, the songs that you do, whatever it is, people are just eating that stuff up alive. You know, do we have the magic formula down right? I'm not sure. You know, it's moving so quickly.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
It's Al's Boring Podcast. With Al Dukes.
And what the other question I get a lot about the streaming is that the same commercials run a lot. What is there some type of rule or something with the union where the commercials that run on the actual radio can't run on the streams?
Well, that's been an ongoing issue since streaming first started a long time ago. You've heard of a union called AFTRA.
Yes.
So the voices you hear on these commercials, whether they are recorded for one radio station like FAN or they are recorded nationally, are all voiced by AFTRA talent who represent broadcasters. So while we have the right to run a, let's say, a John Minko commercial that's recorded just for the WFAN stream because that's part of everybody's deal here, we cannot stream a commercial for, let's say, Geico. We can't stream a commercial for any national advertiser. And because they're all part of our over-the-air broadcast, we have to have these separate streams so that when we go to a commercial terrestrial, I hate the phrase.
Yeah, me too. It's the radio.
We use a radio commercial. The stream has to have another commercial, because were we to broadcast that national after a commercial, the fees are astronomical. It's been a long time since I was involved in that, but to broadcast that fee, you have to pay, broadcast that commercial, you have to pay 2 to 3 times the over-the-air fee, which is just is backwards and has never been resolved. But it also gives us a kind of a second revenue stream, the ability to sell what we do online. And I'm not sure that that after issue will get resolved in my lifetime or yours.
Is podcasting the future? Will I have a job podcasting?
It's funny. Podcasting sort of was, and then it wasn't, and now it is again. And I think it's a great medium. I love the fact that we're doing video out of this radio building with this brand new Adorama soundstage, which is a fabulous facility. And that hopefully will get you involved in doing some interviews and some maybe you'll do some stand up.
Oh yeah,
stuff on there. Some song
nice.
Fest.
Yeah, do some songs.
You know, but podcasting has really become the it thing.
The problem is there's no weeding out process.
It's a lot of stuff, because anybody, unlike starting a broadcast station where you got to have an FCC license and a tower and these beautiful facilities, any idiot can start a podcast.
Right. That's why I started one.
Well, okay. But there's a lot of noise out there, right? There's a lot of junk.
How are people finding these podcasts? Like, I'm fortunate enough to be linked with CBS and Boomer and Carton and FAN. So I know people, some people can find me.
Well, this is an honest podcast. This is a boring podcast.
Yeah.
I fervently hope I have lived up to the whole ethos of this show.
Yes.
I want it to be as deadly boring as it can. Now, if anybody is actually listening through to the whole thing, mm-hmm. they're out of their minds.
And they say that about podcasts, right? People don't.
Yeah.
Because anytime I'm dealing with advertisers for the podcast, you always get these notes from the ad people. They go, this has to run in the first 15 minutes. Because know people are shutting this off.
Well, I can't speak to that. But if I had a company, I would own this thing. I would have this thing just wrapped up lock, stock, and barrel.
Right, own the podcast.
I would just wrap it in my, I would, beyond belief. But there are a gazillion podcasts out there. There's a gazillion. Look at how many radio shows are on in this town.
Yeah, it's too many.
Well, so the cream rises to the top.
Yes.
But still, even if you're number one in this town, 18 out of 20 people don't listen to you.
Right.
If you have a 10 share and people come close, some of these shows come close to 10 shares in certain demographics, it's unusual. 80, 90, 90% of the audience never listens to you, never know who you are.
Right.
Podcasting is even harder to stand out because you're not on this giant, these two giant radio stations. But you'll achieve a certain reputation and a salaciousness due to your wonderful ability to be as boring as. Now I don't know how you do that because you achieve.
I embrace it.
You embrace it. You achieve new levels, new lows or highs, depending on your perspective.
Depending on how you look at it,
of boringness.
Yes.
But I thought it was a bold, daring name.
Thank you.
Caught my eye,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted to hear it.
Al's Boring Podcast.
Just fabulous.
I did that. Started doing that with my tweets, Al's Boring Tweets, because what I expected was when I would write something, people would write back, "Who cares?" So I put it in the name. So I go, I know you don't care. That's why I put the name in.
They do care, don't they?
Sometimes.
Yeah. It's amazing what people care about, isn't it?
Yes.
It's just amazing.
That is true, yes.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time. Even though podcasts really have no time. I didn't get to any of your 10-10 win stuff, but we've gone on very long time. Thank you very much. Since you're
Thank
in
you,
charge
Al.
Of this whole digital thing, I would expect this podcast to be promoted everywhere. Like, well, maybe
it,
a
it depends. I have to listen to it first. If it sucks as bad as I think it did.
They're always better listening back.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love a 10-10 wins mention, the one, whatever is the most listened to part. Like, do-do-do-do-do-do. And right before they do the headlines, they're brought to you by Al's Boring Podcast, and then they go into the headlines or the traffic reports.
I know people. We could probably arrange that.
See if you can work that in there.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
It's good being had.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
See you.